Once upon a time, a famous Protestant historian fell into conversation with a Roman Catholic bishop who did not know his visitor. In the course of their conversation, the bishop proudly mentioned that his church possessed the bones of the Apostle Paul. The Protestant scholar was too polite to say that he was doubtful of that claim, so he simply said modestly, "We too have some relics of St. Paul." "Oh, really?" said the priest. "What are they?" His visitor replied, "We have some letters," he wrote. "Well, we do indeed. And if in some places they really are relics, as dead and dry as old bones, in other places they are as lively and relevant as if they were written last week. One of those letters was written by the Apostle Paul to the new Christian church at Rome, and I would like to talk about certain themes from that letter over the next few Sundays. I will be highly selective because at least half of the book of Romans no longer has much appeal except to a church historian. Like all of Paul's letters, this one has an ad hoc quality, written for the needs of a specific time and place, with all kinds of intricate arguments about Jewish law and history and where non-Jewish Christians fit into all that. Not the sort of thing you come to hear on Sunday morning. But it also has moments of insight as fresh as a baby's face, and I am excited by the thought of sharing those moments from the pulpit. Following the first century pattern for Greco-Roman letter writers, Paul begins by identifying first himself and then the people to whom he writes. People called, he says, to be saints, a word that has a very interesting history. For a long time now, we have used the word saint to mean someone superhuman, better by bushels than the rest of us. We think of a figure in a stained glass window, somebody with a long robe, a holy look, and a halo about the head. And because of that meaning, we are distinctly uncomfortable at the thought of somebody's calling us a saint. How often have you heard someone start a sentence with this disclaimer? "I'm no saint," but that way of using the word would have puzzled Paul. For him, anyone trying to live a Christian life was a saint. The Greek word he used suggested a calling, a vocation, a commitment by somebody who might not be anywhere close to perfection, but was consciously trying to move in that direction. Saint is an aristocratic word today, used by Catholic Christians to describe men and women of such extraordinary goodness that they are venerated on earth and prayed to after their deaths. People like St. Francis, St. Christopher, St. Agnes. But for Paul, the word was a democratic word. He would say that all of you are saints, called to a more thoughtful, sensitive and loving life than those who do not meet for worship in places like this. Modern versions of the Bible, to avoid the misleading stained glass connotations of the word saint, have Paul describe his audience as those who are called to belong to Christ, to be his own people, to be his dedicated people. And that's much closer than modern meanings of the word saint to what Paul actually had in mind. And it's good to be reminded that we are not here just because of good friends or proximity to where we live or because we enjoy the choir and the beauty of this room. We belong to someone. We have a calling to care about. We are dedicated to something beyond our own enjoyment. To people like us, as he begins his letter, Paul wishes the blessings of grace and peace, a combined Greek and Semitic blessing. I think there are few words in the English language more beautiful than the word grace. In my unabridged dictionary, there are 21 definitions of it and 21 synonyms for it, and they are all good. But for Paul, the word specifically meant the blessedness of getting more than one deserves. On the day when it dawns on you that your life has been touched by grace, wonderful changes start to take place in your personality. If I, for example, really believe that it is through the grace of my parents' love and devotion that I made something halfway decent of my life, then I have left myself a lot less room for conceit and arrogance. The grace concept implies that we are never entirely self-made men or women. And the moment we realize that is a defining moment in our lives. I remember a phone call one day in which a grown child caught on to the meaning of grace in his life, getting him to stick with university studies through graduation was not easy. He tried 3 schools, dropped out for a year, wondered if college was worth it, until one day, because his mother and father pushed and prodded, and because he finally finished, he got the job he wanted. And on that day, he called to say quietly and with deep feeling, "Thanks, Mom and Dad, for doing more for me than I deserved." We are better people when we learn how often our lives are touched by grace, by gifts of love and trust beyond anything we have earned. One of America's great preachers, Carlyle Marney, a genuine man and not a plastic doll with a pious face, understood the meaning of grace when he became the pastor of a large church with lots of movers and shakers in it, people used to having their own way. You may know such a church. He confessed to a close friend that he prayed this prayer about a weakness of his. Lord, you have called me to manage hard-headed people, control my temper, even if I can't help but cuss at least once a week. A year later, his friend asked if the prayer had worked. Oh, yes, Carlyle said, although I'm already 10 years overdrawn on the weekly cussing. We all have accounts overdrawn on the grace of God. Paul is still thinking of the grace that came into his own life when he writes a moment later that he is living in the red, that he is in debt to all sorts of people, whether they're college trained, like himself, or illiterate. He feels forgiven by God for so many mistakes in his own life that the only way he can ever repay the debt is by extending that same love and forgiveness to others through the gospel which he preaches. We talk a great deal nowadays about how to build character in our children. One way is to teach them that they are indebted, that they owe something to life. The modern idiom for many is to brag, "I don't owe nothing to nobody." A piece of nonsense that is always false and always destructive. I would have wished my parents to have had an easier life, but I realize how good it was for me that they had to sacrifice when I first went off to college. How could I goof off when I knew every day that I was indebted for more help than they could afford to give? I'm glad Paul begins the Roman letter by reminding us how often we are blessed beyond our merits, living by grace. I wonder next exactly why Paul says, right after telling the new Christians at Rome how eager he is to see them, that he is, after all, not ashamed of the gospel. Why would he say that? Had someone told him he should be? Had one of his old classmates back in the school of Gamaliel said one day, "Paul, you are a Harvard graduate. Why are you wasting your time with all this nonsense about a convicted felon knowing the secret of life?" Or maybe it didn't have to come from outside. It may have been a question Paul sometimes asked himself. Not long before he wrote this letter, he had taken his message to Athens, the ancient equivalent of MIT or Berkeley, and people had made fun of him. Epicurean and Stoic philosophers standing in his audience one day insulted him by calling him a babbler, a word that in Greek literally means a seed picker, used first about birds and then by extension about anyone who picks up odds and ends, who runs about with a kind of grab bag of unrelated bits of philosophy. The kind of person beautifully described by Shakespeare as a snapper up of unconsidered trifles. Well, Paul was nervous around people who could insult him like that before some of the brightest people in the civilized world. So he tried to dress up his simple story, his rather unbelievable story, in elegant rhetoric. And many people feel that he fell flat on his face. He was still stinging from his failures when he went on from Athens to Corinth, where he sat down one day and wrote this letter to Rome about people who, claiming to be wise, became fools. I think he must have been hurting. Paul is only human, after all, and you can imagine how he felt, making tents in Corinth to support himself while he dreamed of taking his message to the capital of the Western world. Some of you have seen it. Even the ruins of that city today can stir your imagination. What must Rome have been like in the fullness of its imperial splendor? Laughed at so recently, Paul must have had serious qualms about going into that city, and especially as a Jew. There are plenty of insults to Jews in the Latin literature of the time. So into that teeming city, with its immense power and pride, would come a minority person. Not so bad if he has other qualities to win respect. But he admits in his letter that he isn't impressive to look at and that he's not a great speaker. Even if he were, smart people had already laughed at his story of suffering love, that a Jewish peasant who passed for the son of a carpenter and died like a criminal in the company of thieves was actually a demonstration of the love of God reaching out to people. Who would believe it? Even Paul's own Jewish countrymen rejected the young prophet Jesus when they saw he would never build an army and lead it into battle against the occupying Roman soldiers. Their whole country was like a banked fire with little flames of rebellion ready to spring up into a holocaust. All Jesus would have had to do at the height of his fame was fan that fire, and even Rome might have had trouble with so fierce and fanatic a people. But to tell them now that even though their one-time hope had been executed, he had somehow conquered the only world worth winning was an unbearable insult. They were too smart for that. How do you trust a God who reveals his strength in weakness, his victory in defeat, his power through surrender? But the cross, the scholar Paul had discovered, was Christ's way of winning. It was the last thing he had to offer to the world's fierce ambitions, and he hoped to change them by bringing a strange new power into existence, a kind of love that would sacrifice itself before it would use the wrong way to win. People laughed then, as they do now, at such folly. Except for a few here and there who wondered if it might not be, after all, the final wisdom. Who knows for sure, even to this day, which is right? But the idea never quite turns loose of us. A child of God, like ourselves, who after malice and hate had done their very worst to him, simply went on loving. Surely, in the end, Paul must have told himself, the human heart cannot withstand the power of love like that. The mightiest intellect, soon or late, has to bow before it. We thrill to great victories in sports, on the field of battle, in high finance, in the arts, and over, we come back to the truth Paul had learned, that unconditional love is ultimately the most powerful thing in human life. So he is obliged, this unimpressive and sometimes nervous little man, to remind us that there is such a thing as the erudite fool who has lost touch with ultimate values, who in G.K. Chesterton's memorable description knows the last word about everything and the first word about nothing. The last word about glamour, but not the first word about the true grace of living. The last word about getting, but not the first word about giving. The last word about lust, but not the first word about love. And as there are such people, there are also others, Paul says, who seeming to be simple are wise. When I saw Godspell down a century 2 years ago, I felt great sympathy for its presentation of Christ as a kind of divine fool. Godspell is simply the old Anglo-Saxon word for gospel, but it hints at another idea, someone under the spell of God, intoxicated with the God idea, drunk on a vision of love that suffers until it wins. And Christ was drunk like that. In the musical, he is a sort of madman who is tolerated as one might a child, but who every once in a while speaks a word that penetrates all of life's pretenses and touches every heart to a stunned, sudden silence. And then for a moment or so on stage, there is an awed recognition that somehow this laughing, clowning, foolish, wise man has stumbled and danced his way into the ultimate understanding. This is Godspell's moment of glory, this notion that what we tolerated tenderly as we might some backward child turns out against all common sense to be the wise fool who redeems our silly life from its tedious hypocrisies. An interesting thing happened last week in that championship football game between Dallas and Green Bay, when the assistant coach for Green Bay was hit by accident on the sideline. It was obvious to people nearby, and in a moment, it was obvious to millions of us on replays that his head injury was very serious. And suddenly, the whole wild kaleidoscope of action was frozen. 70,000 fans forgot the game and bent forward, hushed, hoping a man only a handful of them knew was all right. Millions of people sitting before television around the country watched with deep concern. Now I look always for moments of hope in a world where so many things go wrong. And I found one that afternoon as all of us waited and wished that stranger well, because, no need to be afraid to say it, we felt love for a fellow human being. Now, I'm not talking about the emotion we call love that leads to courtship, romance, or marriage. An emotion that wants something in return for what it gives. I'm talking about what Paul called agape, that deep concern for the welfare of another one may not even know. If there was a single buffoon present in the stadium that day who yelled, "Hey, let's get on with the game," nobody reported it. And I like to think there wasn't, even in the Cowboys stadium in Dallas. Kind of desperate hope, perhaps, but I hope it, because as the announcers who make a handsome living from the game said, at this moment, football is not important. They didn't have to tell us what was, because we knew. So, no need to be ashamed to preach your gospel, Paul. It's the truest and best wisdom we ever learned.